And now, Maine's best guest list, live from Bangor on WZON The Pulse, WKIT HD3, and the WZON app, this is Downtown with Rich Kimball.
And welcome to a very special edition, Downtown Meets the Beatles. Hour two of our special salute brought to you by United Insurance, 890 Hammond Street in Bangor, and online at unitedinsurance.net, and by Slipping Gears Cycling at 753 Stillwater Avenue in Bangor, Bangor's best full-service bike shop. Rich Kimball and Kerry Haskell here, remembering the Beatles' 50th anniversary year of Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band, and we've assembled an all-star team to talk about the Beatles, memories of them, and their influence. This hour of the program, we hear from Colin Hay, Jimmy Webb, Bob Ryan of the Boston Globe, Dan Epstein of Rolling Stone, Beatles blogger Mark Cartier, and we begin this hour by talking with Elliot Mintz, the former broadcaster who became good friends with John Lennon and Yoko Ono, and recalled for us how he first came to know Mr. and Mrs. Ono Lennon.
A day later when Yoko called, just stopped me and said that, you know, usually when people interviewed her, they would ask two or three questions about her, and then it would all be about John, and then it would be about the Beatles. And she said that she liked the fact that I think on the first occasion we spent an hour and a half, and we only talked about Yoko only. And that, you know, I of course was delighted that she was pleased and that she took the time to call. And we had a little chat. And a day or two later, after telling some friends about the Yoko call, and everybody being somewhat surprised, this was, keep in mind, at the height of their popularity, post-Beatles, 1971, months after Imagine had been released, everybody knew who John and Yoko was. I called her, and I told her how pleased I was that she had called me. And we talked, and I think in that first call we talked for an hour or two. And what that evolved into immediately was Yoko and I spoke by phone virtually every night for the next 6 or 7 weeks. She's a very early riser in Manhattan. I'm an insomniac in L.A. So, 3, 4 a.m. is prime time for me. It's 6, 7 a.m. her time. She's beginning her day. And we would start the day together and have lengthy conversations, philosophical primarily in nature. And one day her husband voiced some curiosity as to who she was going off to and speaking to in the other room. And she said, it's Elliot, you know, the guy who did that interview. And he said that he'd like to talk to me too. She suggested we do an interview. I did my first one with John, and not surprisingly, I guess, by that time, it led to a telephone conversation with John, who slept later and got into the habit of calling me just before I was going to sleep. Between the two of them, and these were separate calls, they weren't on extension phones, it's possible that I was speaking to John now 2-3 times a week, an hour or so on each occasion, so much so that I had a separate telephone line put in the house with a number that only the two of them had, a little red light above the phone, because I had three other lines. So one was for business, one was for personal, one was the John Yoko hotline. And that those conversations went on until they drove across the United States and said that they would like to meet me.
And is it true that that first face-to-face with John took place in a field in Ojai?
Yes. The person who was driving them at the time, this old car, from the two of them drove from New York to L.A. Neither of them had seen America from the ground. John only saw America as a Beatle, you know, from the air and stadiums. Yoko had hardly seen it at all. So, they just got into this car. A friend of theirs did the driving. It looked like I keep always describing it as a Rambler station wagon. Maybe it was that. Maybe it was a different type of station wagon, but large enough for them to sit in the back, but a kind of funky car. It certainly wasn't a limo. And it also had this ridiculous 45 RPM turntable hooked up to the bottom of the dashboard that John could play 45s on. And needless to say, if you went over a pebble, the tone arm would skip. But he liked the sound. They were heading in this direction. I think they made a left on the 405 and wound up in Ojai, a little community about 60 or 70 miles from Los Angeles, from Beverly Hills. And that's where they called and said, here's the description of the car, here's the field. And, you know, I wasted no time and was able to locate an old, what looked like an Ash Rambler in the middle of a field, and drove up next to it and got out. And Yoko exited the car first. John said, go on, give him a hug.
Now, they had to be on their guard at that time in their career. What was it about you that made them trust you and feel like you could be not just a friend, but one of the closest confidants?
God only knows. A question that I, of course, never put to John and to this day have not asked Yoko, and she hasn't addressed it either. I think much of it may have to do with the fact that I never asked anything from them. I mean, I asked if I could interview them. They said yes. When the interview was over, it could have ended that way. They did thousands of interviews. Maybe there was something about the exchange. I don't know a whole lot about music. We didn't talk too much about music. It wasn't as if I was a Beatle freak at that time. I was 18, 19 years old by then, I guess. And I was a John and Yoko fan. I liked everything that they stood for. But I was a little old for the original Beatles, Ed Sullivan, Mop Top experience. Although I obviously loved music, it didn't take up any of our time on the phone. We had a lot of common interests having to do with philosophy and history and religion, things of that nature. And I think that there was a meaningfulness to the conversation that the two of them were not always exposed to. Most of the people that they met, frankly, during most of their lives, tended to be people who were more interested in Beatle John and the avant-garde artist than the essence of what these human beings were about. Outside of that, and what I call just pure damn luck, beats me.
We're talking with Elliot Mintz. As you got to know them better and became friends, what was something that surprised you? What was unexpected about them?
So much about them surprised me. When the three of us would just be hanging out together, as we did 100 times at least, they were not full of themselves. They were not, they didn't exude this sense of celebrity. You would, after 15 minutes or so, just lose track of their individual celebrity pedigree. I frequently said that John was one of the people who took off the makeup first in the history of show business. It was one of the things that endeared him to people, that he wasn't hustling you. It wasn't a hype. It wasn't fraudulent. There wasn't a, quote, image. Maybe the Beatles, to some degree, were told to dress a certain way and cut their hair in a certain style and what poses might work best for album covers. But when it was John and Yoko on their own, they wrote their own scripts, and they lived their lives with great bravery and frankness. So when you spoke with them, there was an overwhelming sense of passion for the things that they believed in. They didn't try to play it safe. They were, on that level, intellectual renegades. They weren't following anybody. They weren't proselytizing. They were innately curious. It was a very, very unique dynamic. It's the kind of thing that those are the kind of character things that I look for in other people and sometimes come up to dry. With Johnny, you never left them without feeling that you learned something new. They were provocateurs of thought.
What made John's murder even more tragic in so many ways is the fact that it seemed, and would this be accurate to say, that he had found by late 1980 that very rare thing, peace and fulfillment at home and a creative outlet that also satisfied him?
I think it's inaccurate. It is accurate to say that you know, he certainly had traveled a long and winding road, and it was not without its missteps. And, you know, of course, one can list all of the marvelous opportunities that were bestowed upon him by virtue of his creativity as well as the celebrity. But to a degree, as we have since learned by looking at the fate of others, that kind of international, nonstop celebrity imprisons a lot of people and leads to all kinds of dangerous behavior. With John, by 1979, 1980, he felt at home in New York, and he could walk down the streets without crowds. I'd walk the streets with him. We had taken walks through Central Park. And, almost everybody knew him. Most people would nod. Occasionally, somebody would ask for an autograph or say thanks for the music. But it wasn't as if he was shopping in a store and 600 people were going to break the glass windows and that he needed a police escort to get out. Those days were behind him. I think he received great comfort from his relationship with his son. That Sean was 5 years old at that time, and the two of them were as father and son. And yes, after a period of retirement, when the Double Fantasy album came out, and he received some marvelous attention for it, although it had not been a hit when it first came out, it wasn't universally accepted or revered the way it might be today, that took place after he left us. He was satisfied with the work. He was satisfied with a disc that he cut for Yoko called Walking on Thin Ice. He liked the synergy of the two of them singing together on Double Fantasy, a tale of a man and a woman exchanging passions, vows, thoughts, fears together on a disc. I knew him from 71 to 80, and if I was to point to a period of time when he seemed to be really cruising, 79, 80, he felt at home.
How proud do you think John would be of the success and the critical acclaim that Yoko has received in recent years for her work?
Well, whereas I've always made it a habit in all of these conversations to, quote, never speak for John, I would say that here's a guy who spent their entire relationship attempting in his way to seek a sense of legitimacy for Yoko's artistry. He was constantly bestowing the most complimentary and meaningful thoughts upon Yoko, and really asking the public to take a close look into her originality, into her writing, into her performance pieces, into her music. It was a cornerstone of his life. So towards the end, when he did that particular song, Thin Ice, which he was very pleased with, and that did receive some attention, that excited him. Well, Yoko has now had umpteen million number one songs on the Billboard dance charts, and throughout the music community, her work has been re-reviewed and spoken of in hallowed terms. And those who had the obvious issues that they may have had with her way back when, I think have come to grips with the fact that she was a woman independent of the criticism, the rumors, and the humiliation, and she's received the kind of respectability that I only wish John had been able to witness in life.
Elliot, what do you miss most about your friend John Lennon?
Being able to just pick up the phone at any given time and calling and saying, what's happening, how you feeling, what are you thinking about? Just the spontaneous exchange that you might have with any good friend. He was, in those days, the network news was, he watched the CBS News with Walter Cronkite, which of course would be on 3 hours before I would see it in Los Angeles. And often when the newscast ended, he would call me and say these are the things he wanted me to look for in the coverage so we could talk about it later. And I would take a couple of notes as to the stories that he wanted me to watch. He would send me books to read and say, you know, let's talk about this after you've gotten a chance. And some of it was just, not all of it was that heavy or intellectually, it wasn't pretentious. There were times we just called each other to laugh or have a joke. He occasionally liked to gossip, wanted to know what was going on in Hollywood, wanted to know who I was interviewing, what they were like. When I told him that Mort Saul had arranged me to see Elvis in Vegas, he got tremendously excited and he said, look, after you see him, I want you to go right back upstairs to the hotel room and call me and tell me everything that you saw and what he sang and how he looked. And he said, I will. And I said, you know, one of these days, maybe you could come out and see him. This was, you know, when Elvis was no longer the Elvis that he grew up listening to and put on some weight and wasn't in the best of shape. And I gave him the report on the telephone right after the phone only rang half of one ring, and he picked it up, and with rapt attention, I gave him the report. He listened intently, and I did tell him. He asked if it would be worth coming out to see him, and I said, it would, John, but, you know, here's the key. If, you know, obviously, you would be off stage somewhere where nobody would see you. And if you kind of half close your eyes and just listen, it would be Elvis. And he paused and said, no, I don't want to do that. I don't want to have to half close my eyes and pretend. He never got to see him. And the next time we really had a conversation about Elvis was the day that he died, when I called John in Japan to break the news to him that Elvis was dead. And the very next day, I flew to Japan to be with Yoko and John. So a long way of getting around the fence as to, you know, isolating what I miss most. I miss the his intelligence and his wit and his humor and just the spontaneity of our conversations. It was I obviously was in a very rare position here. And we trusted each other, and, you know, I never talked out of school, never gossiped, never tried to merchandise the memories or betray the trust. He lived to see that, of course. Yoko still does. So, I miss him.
Elliot Mintz, remembering his friend John Lennon here on Downtown Meets the Beatles, a special edition Best of Downtown program, and among those influenced by the Beatles, a young musician by the name of Colin Hay, who knew them intimately because of his family's ownership of a record store.
For me, there was the Beatles, and then there was everybody else, because I grew up in a music shop from the years 1958 until 1967. My mother and father had a music shop in Scotland before I went to Australia. So, you know, when the Beatles first hit, my father was the first one to play me the Beatles in the shop when it was closed at night. He said, have a listen to these guys. He said, I think they'll do well, and and didn't they? But that's an extraordinary thing, isn't it? When you listen to the Beatles and you listen to any record you like, whether it's Please Please Me or, you know, with the Beatles or right through to the stuff they were doing towards the end of their career, there it's just such a beautiful arc of creative development, isn't it? And you can still get this incredible amount of energy by listening to a song like Please Please Me, because when you hear that music, you know, it seems that there's something else in there apart from the four of them. There was just the four of them playing, but it just seems like there's this magic stick in there as well or something. You know, it's extraordinary. So, yeah, I'm a complete lover of the Beatles.
Being such a fan of the Beatles when you were a kid, what was it like to get the chance to join in with Ringo's all-star band for a couple of tours, right, you did with them?
Yeah, I did a couple of tours and a couple of a television special with Ringo and a song last year as well that he did for charity, which was a nice thing. Oh, look, fantastic. There's no downside to playing in Ringo's band. It's a beautiful experience. You play with all different musicians and play lots of different songs, and you get to hang out with Ringo. So there's nothing wrong with it at all.
Help, I need somebody. Help, not just anybody. Help, you know I need someone. Help. When I was younger, so much younger than today, anybody's help in any way. But now these days are gone, I'm not so self-assured. Now I find a change of mind and open up the doors. Help me if you can, I'm feeling down, and I do appreciate you being right.
About buying a pre-owned vehicle? Experience the pre-owned difference with Quirk Auto Group. Every pre-owned vehicle from Quirk comes with a Carfax vehicle history report, a Quirk certified pre-owned inspection, a 3-month, 3,000-mile limited warranty, and state inspections for the life of the vehicle. That's the Quirk pre-owned difference. Experience it for yourself at more than 10 statewide locations. It's your car. Find it at Quirk, quirkauto.com. Wholesale vehicles excluded from the 3-month, 3,000-mile limited warranty and main state inspections.
Road bike, mountain bike, hybrid, recumbent, tandem, no one size fits all when it comes to quality bicycles for the road or the trails. If you're interested in any type of bike, see the experts at Slipping Gears Cycling, 753 Stillwater Avenue in Bangor, Bangor's best full-service bike shop. Outstanding service, huge stock. Like them on Facebook for updates. Shop in person and online at slippinggears.com.
Do we ever agree on anything?
We both like the Bangor Mall Cinema 10.
The cozy stadium seating.
I like the bargain prices for all shows on Tuesday.
Hot buttered popcorn and candy.
The Dolby and digital surround sound is perfect.
I think I'll have a birthday party there for the kids.
I've got 2 tickets.
I hope one of them's for me.
So we can check out that action movie.
No, romance. Comedy.
The Bangor Mall Cinema 10 at 557 Stillwater Avenue in Bangor. Call 942-1303 or visit online at yourneighborhoodtheater.com.
From Fort Kent to Portland, if you need insurance, turn to United. United Insurance is one of the largest independent insurance agencies in Maine, featuring a wide variety of personal and commercial insurance products. Backed by a select group of carriers, United delivers guidance and friendly personal attention. For commercial needs, talk with Pat Gattani or Todd Sosier. For personal auto and home insurance, talk to Navilla Rollins. Call United Insurance 207-385-2077 or online at unitedinsurance.net.
Hi, this is Eric.
And Christine.
From the Bangor Wine and Cheese Company, inviting you to come in and shop our carefully cultivated selection of fine wine, craft beer, meads, and ciders, and experience what has made Bangor Wine a fixture of Bangor's downtown for over 15 years.
Taste our delicious new Tavolo specialty oils and vinegars, artisan cheeses, cured meats, and crusty baguettes.
Bangor Wine and Cheese offers the service and knowledge to help anyone from the seasoned buyer to the nervous newcomer.
Bangor Wine and Cheese, family owned and operated since 2000, is located at 86 Hammond Street in the heart of downtown Bangor.
Drink, eat, live better.
1, 2, 3, 4. 1, 2.
Let me tell you how it will be. There's one for you, 19 for me.
We're back on the best of downtown. Downtown meets the Beatles. Up next, our friend Dan Epstein, the author of two great baseball books, Big Hair and Plastic Grass, and Stars and Strikes, but also a very talented music journalist who talked with us about the Beatles.
I mean, obviously, the music was incredible. I think a lot of it has to do with the personalities of the members. I mean, I think everyone has their favorite Beatle even today. My wife's is Ringo, mine is John. I think a lot of it too is just that they kind of set the template for rock groups as we know them and as we, identify with them and absorb what they do. Obviously there was a lot of good music that came out before the Beatles, but I don't think there was a band before, there really wasn't a band before them where people cared about every member of the band, where, you know, even the Beach Boys, who were huge and amazing and putting out records really pretty much at the exact same time that the Beatles were. I don't think people cared as much about like the individual members and what they brought to the table, but there was something about the Beatles where we just, we were just drawn to all four of them and intrigued by how the four worked together. I mean, I think you can look at all of their respective solo careers and find, plenty of good music. I'm a huge fan of Paul McCartney's Wings period, for example, but I think nothing any of them did, on their own ever reached the magic that they did, that they had together, which is why, up until Lennon was killed, There were all through the 70s, there were stories in you'd hear rumors on the radio, you'd read stories in the newspaper, the talk of like maybe the Beatles are getting back together. There was just this thing that kind of hung over the decade. Like we couldn't move on from it. They were just this sort of touchstone for not just for their generation, but for the generations that came after them.
And they did so many things first. There had been other people who wrote their own music, but really, as a group, they were the first that did that in the pop music realm. They were the first to give up touring and retreat to the studio to make music. And then They were the first group, really, of any note that just stopped at the peak of their popularity. And I think that's probably part of the reason why people wanted them to get back together, because no one could understand the inner workings and why they would give up when it was going so great.
Right. I think, you know, by now we all understand why bands break up, why, you know, the personality and ego difficulties that can get in the way, and also just the way that artists burn out and need to seek new horizons and new contexts for their work. But in 1970, when it was announced that the Beatles were breaking up, it was just kind of like, wait a minute, you know, you can't do that. You're the Beatles. This is what we know. And people had been looking to them to kind of lead, you know, whether it was, you know, musically or socially or whatever. They were this kind of, you know, these avatars. But I mean, you mentioned about them being the first in so many things. And I think what's interesting too about them is they're really, they never repeated themselves. I think you look at any one of their songs and it's hard to find, you know, so many bands kind of come out with a hit. I mean, even today, artists will come out with a hit and the next one sounds pretty close to the previous one because they want to remind you of the hit. And the Beatles never did that. They were really, with everything they wrote, they were trying to forge a way forward and find some new, you know, new inspiration, new sounds, new techniques. And I think that's, to me, one of the most amazing things when I go back and listen to the records. It's just like they all have their own character.
And I think it's a hallmark of their talent and their popularity that they came out at a time when singles were the coin of the realm. Nobody cared about albums. They helped to change that image, but they also blurred the lines during that singles top 40 era that some of their best known songs were never released as singles. And everybody knows the deepest cuts on every Beatles album. And you can't say that for many artists.
No, absolutely not. And you know, I mean, you can argue about maybe some Beatles deep cuts being underrated or, you know, but really it's like even people who are not hardcore music fans will know a song like, say, Tomorrow Never Knows or Rain, you know, to name two of my favorites that were, you know, neither of which were hits, but are still so embedded in the pop cultural consciousness. It's pretty interesting how that worked.
We're talking with Dan Epstein here on Downtown. Do you have a favorite Beatle album?
Yeah, I'm a Revolver man. I think to me that's not only is it packed with so many incredible songs, but to me that's really the height of their in their creativity and their experimentalism before you get into the whole Sgt. Pepper Magical Mystery Tour, just like complete studio, you know, all studio all the time. I mean, when they were making Revolver, they were still, you know, coming off the road and we're still very much in the, you know, we're a band mindset as opposed to we're, you know, mad scientists or, four individual artists trying to work together, you know, which is not to put down Sgt. Pepper. Although I was actually listening to Sgt. Pepper last night, the new 50th anniversary, edition. And it really occurred to me that as much as I enjoy that record, I feel like there are so many records from 1967 and early 68 that were influenced by Sgt. Pepper that were actually better than Sgt. Pepper, but it was like the world needed the Beatles to do a Sgt. Pepper before artists felt like they had the freedom to go off and experiment like that.
Well, let's talk about that, and let's talk about influences. Do groups today, do musicians today continue to be influenced by what the Beatles did?
Oh, I think so. I don't think there's any. I mean, I don't think you're seeing a diminishment of the Beatles' influence. I think there are, you know, it may be in more subtle ways than, say, like, I mean, there was a period in the late 70s, for instance, where we had, you know, there was this huge kind of power pop explosion, all these bands like The Knack and The Plimsolls and stuff like that, who were really obviously drawing from like the Beatles' early to mid 60s catalog, but kind of, you know, making it louder and more punkier even. So I don't think you see things like that today, but I think in whether it's the way artists, you know, will build a track in the studio, I think a lot of that goes back to the way the Beatles and George Martin built albums like Sgt. Pepper but also I think just the inherent tunefulness and hookiness of the songs and the way that I feel like they taught several generations of songwriters like the way to kind of reach out through the speaker and grab people and make them pay attention and beyond that identify with the music. I mean, you know, from I Want to Hold Your Hand on, it's like you know, they're either talking about me or they're talking to me or you know, this all applies to me somehow.
Thank you, by the way, for mentioning The Plimsolls, Oldest Story in the World, one of my favorite songs from that time period.
Oh, so such a great band. The Oldest Story in the World, they play that in Valley Girl, which is one of my all-time favorite movies from the 80s.
So many bands claimed or were proclaimed by others to be the next Beatles, and that's such an unfair comparison. But did anybody come close in your mind?
Wow. No. I mean, like the fact that it's taking me this hard to even come up with something would tell me that the answer is no. I mean, I think there have been so many great bands from, you know, from the Rolling Stones and the Who onward who, you know, were influenced by the Beatles on some level. But I don't think there's ever been, another Beatles that have come close. Although I'll tell you, one of my all-time favorite bands, which is very obscure and very Beatles influenced, was a band called Los Shakers. And they were from, they're a 1960s band from the country of Uruguay. And they all kind of looked like Ringo, but they're incredible musicians. And they may just released one song after another that kind of like the Beatles. I mean, they were clearly influenced by the Beatles. And I think being in Uruguay, they were about a year behind. So they would release, say, a song in 1967 that was very, you know, influenced by 1966 Beatles. But they were great. And their stuff is not that easy to find. I think maybe there's one album of theirs on Spotify. I mean, they made one of the greatest Sgt. Pepper influence records of all time, a record called The Secret Treaty of Toto's Bar, which is absolutely wonderful. And if you can find it on the internet, I highly recommend giving it a listen.
Now, a group that didn't have, obviously, any measure of the success of the Beatles, but I thought really captured the sound and the feel on some of their best records, Squeeze, and then even later on when it was just Difford and Tilbrook off on their own.
Yeah, I think Difford and Tilbrook, their partnership was very, very reminiscent of Lennon and McCartney, where it's like, you know, you throw the two guys in a room and they'll come out with a song, and you know, nine times out of ten that song will be really catchy and hooky. And I'm a big Squeeze fan. I remember being kind of offended at the time when I think what was the record, Argy Bargy, came out with Pulling Muscles from a Shell.
Yes.
And Another Nail Through My Heart, and I remember they were being kind of hyped as the next Lennon and McCartney, and as a fan at the time, of a huge fan of the Beatles at the time, I sort of took umbrage, like, you know, how dare you? But I definitely think they drew a lot from the Beatles, and you know, while doing, you know, carving out their own niche and were incredibly talented in their own right. But yes, obviously owe some debt to the Beatles.
So does this end anytime soon? I mean, we're on, I guess, our third generation or so of Beatles fans. Do they become our version of classical music? And 50 years from now, will people still be talking about what they did?
I think so. I think, you know, it's like their Beatles books are still popular. Beatles reissues are still big news. I think, I mean, it's almost like, I think as we get further and further away from it, it almost has kind of a fairy tale quality to it. And, you know, it's like when you're a kid and you just never got tired of hearing the same, you know, bedtime stories, fairy tales. It's the same with the Beatles. Like, I mean, you know, I've forgotten more about the Beatles at this point than a lot of people know, but I still don't get tired of reading about them. I'm literally reading the new Mojo magazine with the Sgt. Pepper's cover story on it as we speak. And, you know, I would say, like, I already know about 98% of what's in the article on the record, but that 2% keeps me coming back. You know, I just got to learn a little more about them.
That's Dan Epstein talking Beatles with us here on a special edition Best of Downtown. Well, some people were influenced by the Beatles, and certainly in that time period, back in the 1960s, there was so much competition between songwriters, especially, whether it was Lennon and McCartney with the Beatles, or Brian Wilson with the Beach Boys, or someone like our friend Jimmy Webb, who took cues from what the Beatles were doing, but explained to us that sometimes it went both ways as well. When he recorded and wrote MacArthur Park, he found out that the Beatles were a bit influenced by that too, particularly the length of the song, which Jimmy explained caused the Beatles to add a little bit of extra time to the end of Hey Jude.
Changed things for a while. I mean, it actually shook up top 40 radio's playlists because they had their 3-minute songs and they had their commercials and they were slotted in there pretty tightly. And then all of a sudden, here's this record that's 7 minutes, 21 seconds long. And they were playing it, all of it. And I was getting paid 3 times. I was getting paid for 3 songs
right,
every time
right.
they played it. So, yes, and the story was recounted to me by George Martin, and I've never had any reason to doubt. And I made a record with it and always loved the guy. That they all went to the studio one night and they made a tape loop for the end of Hey Jude, and they all stood at the console and put a new ending on the record that measured out to, I believe it was 7 minutes, 17 seconds.
Sleeping. There's only one way Hartley's Chrysler Dodge Jeep Ram in Newport does business. The right way. Owned and operated for over 60 years by the Hartley family, Hartley's offers the same or even better prices and discounts on vehicles as those offered at mega dealerships. And along with that comes their renowned small dealer service and exceptional attitude toward you, their customers. Hartley's values your business and your trust. You're never pushed, never pressured. No one will chase you around the lot, but no one will ignore you either. Hartley's wants you to feel comfortable at their dealership. So feel free to look around, and Hartley's professional sales staff will always be there when you need help. You'll like the place, you'll like the people, and you'll like the way they do business. The right way. The folks at Hartley's wouldn't do it any other way. Always remember, if you're out there looking around, the best deals aren't in the city, they're in the country. Hartley's Country, at the Triangle in Newport. You'll always be treated the right way at Hartley's.
From Fort Kent to Portland, if you need insurance, turn to United. United Insurance is one of the largest independent insurance agencies in Maine, featuring a wide variety of personal and commercial insurance products. Backed by a select group of carriers, United delivers guidance and friendly personal attention. For commercial needs, talk with Pat Gattani or Todd Sosier. For personal auto and home insurance, talk to Navilla Rollins. Call United Insurance 207-385-2077 or online at unitedinsurance.net.
When it comes to your health, early detection is the best protection. That's why the St. Joseph Regional Breast Care Center provides 3D mammography to offer better answers and greater peace of mind, identifying problem areas that a standard mammogram might miss. It provides precise images for all women, including those with dense breast tissue. Call 907-1682 to schedule your 3D mammogram at the St. Joseph Regional Breast Care Center. 3D, providing peace of mind for you, your family, and your loved ones.
Green Acres Kennel in Bangor is your source for wholesome food and quality supplies for healthy and happy pets. They pride themselves on their emphasis on quality foods made by small, family-owned companies that are committed to wholesome pet nutrition. The staff at Green Acres Kennel undergoes continuing education on pet nutrition and will never recommend a food that they wouldn't feel comfortable feeding their own pets, no matter how popular it is, and that's what sets them apart from big chains. But don't just go to Green Acres for food. They also carry treats, grooming supplies, training aids, toys, supplements, and accessories like collars, harnesses, and leashes for all your canine and feline friends. And they have excellent prices. Sign up for Green Acres Customer Rewards Program and their Frequent Buyer Program to get the most bang for your buck. Visit them today at greenacreskennel.com or stop by at 1653 Union Street in Bangor.
We love Green Acres Kennel Shop, a home away from home.
We're back on a special edition, Best of Downtown, Downtown Meets the Beatles. And of course, you don't have to be a singer or songwriter to be influenced by and love the Beatles. All kinds of people share that all around the world, including our friend Bob Ryan of the Boston Globe.
I became aware of them in November of the previous year in 63. Jack Parr had a show, and not his late night show. He had another show that I believe was on like 10 to 11 on a Friday night. And he showed an excerpt clip of this hot new band in England that was taking England by storm, the Beatles. That's where I became aware of them. Then, of course, I Want to Hold Your Hand, and I saw her standing there hit in late November or in early December of 63. And that was their first hit here, although their first hit was Love Me Do way back when. And but that came here later. But they hit America with I Want to Hold Your Hand, and of course the flip side, which I like even more, which is I Saw Her Standing There. And so by the time they came in February of 67, of 64, we were all waiting their arrival. It wasn't like I discovered them then. That was welcome to the shores of America.
Do you have a favorite Beatle album?
I have a favorite Beatle album, which is Rubber Soul. And I think, to me there's two kinds of Beatles fans. The kind for whom they peaked with Rubber Soul, or the people think that they really got great with Sgt. Pepper, and then they like the White Album and all that. I'm a first half Beatles guy more than I'm a second half Beatles guy. I love Rubber Soul. I don't think there's a bad cut on the album. I think it's all wonderful. I also like, I like all the early stuff. But Rubber Soul to me was fantastic, and that's my favorite. Nothing against Sergeant Pepper. I like it. But there's some, to me, there's a couple of clunkers. But there's no clunkers on Rubber Soul.
That's Bob Ryan of the Boston Globe. His thoughts on the Beatles. One guy who has been loving the Beatles for a long time, a talented actor. You see him every summer appearing at the theater at Monmouth. He's done several movies and television shows as well. Mark Cartier, also a proud Beatles fan and the author of a terrific blog, sharing his love of his favorite band.
I was one of those who was the perfect age. I was 9 years old when they were on the Ed Sullivan Show in 1964. So I was one of the first generations of Beatle fans. I had a couple of female cousins who were a little bit older than I was, and they were into Elvis and all of the early rock and roll, and that never really grabbed me. And all those crooners and stuff in the early 60s, they were into that, and it meant nothing to me. So the Beatles were the first ones that grabbed me and my generation. So I was right there at the start, I have to say. Yeah.
And ran right out and bought albums or 45s first?
45s. Mom and Dad had one of those big cabinet,
stereos. The console models.
Oh, my God. Yeah. With a diamond-tipped needle. it was just incredible. It was a huge thing, a big piece of furniture in the room.
Did you have to put the little plastic thing in the middle of the 45 to get it to play?
Yes. Yes, and you could stack up multiple records and let them drop and so forth. But I wasn't allowed to have albums right away because I was still a kid. So I had a little plastic record player with batteries. And I had my 45. So I think the first 45 I bought, let me think about that. It was probably Can't Buy Me Love. I don't think I got it. And then the first album was, of course, Meet the Beatles later that year. And the albums cost $2.39.
Wow.
For mono. And I think $3.98, an exorbitant $3.98 for stereo. And I couldn't afford the stereo. So I saved up my pennies and I got the mono albums. That's what I have. And I still have them, and I still play them. They're scratched to hell. They're worth nothing, but I love them. I love them. I have, my wife calls it the low-tech room, where I have my my old turntable and a cassette deck and all that stuff. It's fabulous. I love it.
Now, you're a Massachusetts guy. You didn't make it, I assume, to Suffolk Downs when they were there in, I think, 66 on their last American tour.
No, but one of my female cousins, who I mentioned before, was there. And wow. She said it was fantastic. I remember her saying that they play, she had the set list in her mind. She could remember everything because they were into them by now, too. And I remember her saying that they played Babies in Black. And I thought, what an odd choice for their live show.
Well, especially when they would only play for about a half hour.
Yeah, they played maybe 10 or 11 songs, tops. And that was actually one of the songs that they played live. I don't know why they love that song in particular, because it's pretty obscure even now. Very few people know it, but it made the live set for a year or two.
But you have gone on and grown up and not left the Beatles behind, but if anything, embraced them even more, including a wonderful blog that shares your experiences, but also gives us some inside information on the making of those records.
Yeah, I always come back to the music. I mean, a lot of people are into their lives and the weird things that happened and the lifestyle and the whole thing. But for me, it has always come back to the music. That's what it's about. I listen to some every day. I know I do. And if I don't listen to it in actuality, I'm listening to it in here, in my head right now. So the blog is me wanting to write about every particular album. I started out by going through the British catalog, which we all learned really when everything came out on CD in the late 80s. Here in America, we had a whole different set of albums the first half of their career.
Right.
So to us, it was new to approach things from the British catalog point of view. I went through the entire British catalog. I think I went into a whole bunch of the compilations post-career up until and through the anthology. And then I started over and I went to the American catalog and started writing. And now I've started over because I've been doing it for so long. Now I'm doing A to Z, song by song. And I think I'm only up to E. I think 8 days. No, Eleanor Rigby was my latest entry. So I'm going song by song now.
Obviously, a lot of talk this year about Sgt. Pepper on the 50th anniversary and acclaimed by many musical experts for a long time as the best pop rock album of all time. But I know there are a lot of people who, while they love Sgt. Pepper, wouldn't even call it the best Beatles album. What's your choice?
I think I fall in line with most people nowadays in terms of Revolver, the album just before Sgt. Pepper, as being the absolute best. Sgt. Pepper, no question, and it's really been proven in recent months, is the most influential. Mm. And it's not the most influential Beatles album. It's the most influential album ever by anybody. It changed all of the rules, just the way they approached everything. And everybody followed them. I always describe the Beatles. I used to do talks, too. I would go to libraries and give talks about the Beatles. Don't do it so much anymore. But I talk about them as the prism, kind of like on the cover of the Pink Floyd album. What is that? What is the name of that album?
The Wall?
No, the one with the prism. Here we are.
Gary, help us out there.
Dark Side of the Moon.
Dark Side of the Moon.
Here we go. Old person moment. Okay. But I think of the Beatles as the prism of the 1960s. Everything got filtered through the Beatles, and it came in black and white on one side, even though we know everything wasn't black and white. There were a great range of styles musically, and everything went through the Beatles and came out psychedelic colors on the other side. And when they did something, they were rarely the first to do something, but they were the big influence. Mm-hmm. When they did it, everybody else had to do it. Everybody had to copy them. When George Harrison played the sitar, because he discovered it on the set of Help, of all things, suddenly every lead guitarist of every group on either side of the Atlantic had to learn how to play the sitar, and they had to have it on their album within a year, or because the craze was going to die. You know, everything happened that fast in the 60s. It was crazy how fast things changed.
We're talking with Mark Cartier here on Downtown. And what's remarkable, and I certainly, at least starting with Rubber Soul, there was a stretch where every Beatles album found a way to eclipse the previous one. And I can't think of many artists, many groups that could say that.
No. And they changed almost from album to album from that point on. There's a homogenous thing happening early on with them changing slowly up until Rubber Soul. And Rubber Soul was a rush job. Everybody forgets that.
Right.
They went into the studio, I believe, in October. And this thing had to be on the shelves for Christmas. They churned out this album in about 3 or 4 weeks, and they hadn't written half of the songs when they started. And it's amazing the quality of that album, given those circumstances. With Revolver, the next album, they then took 2 to 3 months for the first time and really stretched out their studio time. And then they said, oh, this is what we want to do all the time now. We want to spend quality time and really turn out a great product, and thus Pepper and so on and so forth.
What about late career Beatles from the White Album, Let It Be, Abbey Road? I think some great work there. I love Abbey Road for the music, but also for what it represents, that it was them trying to do it the way they had one last time, because they sort of knew that this might be it. But even Let It Be, the much maligned Let It Be, has got some wonderful moments on it.
It does have some great moments on it. Mostly McCartney's. I mean, because he drove that whole project.
Right.
So he has some amazing songs. It was originally known as Get Back when they started working on those sessions. It was the Get Back sessions.
Right.
But he has Get Back. He has Let It Be. He has The Long and Winding Road, which is an incredible composition. Oh, my God. How he could let that sit untouched for a year and move on to other material before they came back to it is astonishing, I think, because it's so great. But the rooftop concert from the end of those sessions is just one of the most copied moments again.
Yeah.
It's incredible what they were able to accomplish. The camaraderie was there one last time.
Now, do you have a preference, the Phil Spector produced Let It Be, or when McCartney and George Martin went back and cleaned it up a little bit?
Not so much the Spector, although he has his moments. But I like the Glyn Johns version, which is actually the original version. Glyn Johns was the engineer on those sessions, and George Martin was actually absent much of the time during those sessions because the tensions were so high and he just wanted to get away. So Glyn Johns was not named as the producer, but he kind of was. And he was the one that was originally given the task by John and Paul to go through all the tapes, because those were all live rehearsals with no take numbers. And he had to go through hours and hours and hours to pull out something and make an album out of it. And he made two attempts at creating a Get Back album, both of which were rejected because they said, this is just too raw. Nobody's going to want to listen to this. Nowadays we do.
But now, wasn't it, I think it was John who had said to George Martin, you know, we don't want any of your fancy producer stuff on this.
Yeah. And then, of course, they went completely the opposite direction with Abbey Road right after that, because they started working on songs, doing traditional takes the way they had before. And they had recorded actually a number of numbers in the spring with no set project in mind. And it wasn't until, I think, the early summer that McCartney went up to George Martin and he said, we want to do an album the old way. They already had a number of tracks, and he said full production values, and George Martin said, is everybody in on this? Is John in on this? And he said, yeah, we all want to do it. And then John wound up being absent for a good portion of those sessions because he and Yoko were in a car accident up in Scotland. So they actually recorded a good side of the medley, a good chunk of the medley, without John present.
Right.
But once he came in, they worked together for a sustained period of time to great, the output is incredible that they came up with during that time period.
Do you have a favorite Beatle?
John. I'm a John guy. I was always a John guy right from the start. I don't know why. I have two brothers and a cousin who's very close, and we played the Beatles as kids. We stood there like they did on the Ed Sullivan show. So I was John. My cousin was Paul, because we were the two older ones. My middle brother was George, and then by default, the youngest became Ringo. And we would have to stand and mime to the records in front of our family, and they thought it was, they bought us plastic guitars and a little snare drum for Ringo to play, and it was great. It was fun.
Yeah, and you mentioned the medley at the end of Abbey Road, and I was reading something just the other day, I think it was when I was rereading Peter Ames Carlin's book on McCartney, and McCartney had that idea for the medley, and John was a little reluctant at first.
Yes, he was.
But the more he heard, he really embraced the idea, and for me, I think that's why I love that section, because that's that to me sounds like them, even though it wasn't the last music released.
Right.
It's them saying, this is a look back at all we've done in this remarkable stretch.
Yeah. Paul and George Martin actually came up with the idea of putting all these song fragments together. And Martin told Paul, think symphonically, which I think is why you have, it starts off with You Never Give Me Your Money. And then it's during one of the final songs, Carry That Weight, the third verse of You Never Give Me Your Money appears late in the medley, tying it all together musically. But John was kind of skeptical about it until he was asked, do you have any song fragments you'd like to contribute? And he goes, oh, by the way, yes, I do. And then he wound up getting three in a row with, Sun King, Mean Mr. Mustard, and Paula Pean Pam.
Yeah.
So a good chunk of the medley is his right there. And the end, the final number of the medley, they also have the famous guitar duel, where Ringo takes a brief little drum solo, and he was not one of those guys that liked to play drum solos. He had to be coaxed into doing it. And then the three guitarists take turns playing lead guitar. And according to Jeff Emerick, their engineer, in his book Here, There, and Everywhere, he said they talked about it for a long time, and they knew that they would each have three turns playing lead. So they would, so there were nine sections of lead guitar. So Paul said, well, it's my song, I want to go first. And John said, I've got a great ending. And then by default, George winds up in the middle. But you can hear their three distinctive styles as they go three times through taking lead guitar. And it's an astonishing piece of work. And Emerick says they did it in one take. He says they talked about it for a long time, and then they put the headphones on with the backing track, and they did it in one take. And he said, then they looked at each other. There were no high fives in those days, but they kind of looked at each other, nodded their heads, smiled. They knew that it was one of their last great moments of camaraderie, according to them.
Mark Cartier, as we wrap up our salute, Downtown meets the Beatles. We hope you've enjoyed the last couple of hours of hearing some music and the thoughts of all kinds of people weighing in on the greatest band in the history of popular music, the Beatles. Thanks to everybody who participated in our special salute. We'll see you again next time. You're on Downtown.